This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, an update on South Asia, renewed tensions between India and Pakistan over Kashmir, Indian elections, and prospects for peace with the Taliban in Afghanistan. Hello again. I'm Carol Castiel. On February 14th, a suicide bomber blew up a military bus in Kashmir, killing more than 40 Indian security personnel. That was the deadliest attack in three decades. The group Jaish-e-Mohammed, which operates from Pakistan and is listed as a terrorist organization by the United States, claimed responsibility. In retaliation, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi ordered airstrikes on Pakistan, which he blamed for the attack, and Pakistan struck back. Further conflict followed, resulting in the capture of an Indian pilot shot down by Pakistani forces. The pilot was ultimately released, but tensions remain high between the two nuclear powers. The daring move by Prime Minister Modi, who is running for re-election in April, may have actually bolstered his electoral fortunes, which heretofore were waning due to a slowing economy and high unemployment. While turning to Afghanistan, 2 weeks of talks between the United States and the Taliban ended this week in Doha with some progress, if not a breakthrough. The two sides are still grappling with two major sticking points: a guarantee from the Taliban that Afghanistan would never again host militants that would launch an attack against the United States, and a timeline for withdrawal of U.S. troops. The two sides also disagree about the role of the Afghan government in future talks and the contours of a final political settlement that would end the 18-year conflict. With us to analyze Indian-Pakistani tensions and prospects for peace in Afghanistan are two distinguished analysts. Ambassador Richard Olson is a senior advisor at the U.S. Institute for Peace, and that's a federal institution that promotes conflict resolution and prevention worldwide. Prior to joining the Institute for Peace, Ambassador Olson served as U.S. Special Representative to Afghanistan and Pakistan, as well as U.S. Ambassador to Pakistan and the United Arab Emirates. And Michael Kugelman, he's Deputy Director of the Asia Program and Senior Associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center, and that's a nonpartisan policy group based here in Washington. Michael also contributes to the Wall Street Journal and has published op-eds in a wide range of publications, including the New York Times, Politico, and Al Jazeera. And both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ambassador Olson, it's a delight to have you here for the first, but hopefully not the last time. I'd like to ask you about the recent clash between Pakistan and India. To what extent do you think this escalated tensions significantly between these two nuclear powers? Or by now have things returned, in a sense, to status quo ante? What's different about this?
I think the broad picture, what's different is that for the first time, we had two nuclear-armed states actually involved in a military confrontation, and that is something new. There are a couple of elements here that are also significant and different from what's happened in the past. As you mentioned, the attack in Pulwana on the 14th of February is one of the deadliest in recent times, a huge truck bomb. And the Indian response to that actually involved airstrikes, not just across the line of control, which has happened before, happened actually in 2016, but actually into Pakistan proper, that is beyond Kashmir, into the adjoining province. And so this was, in a way, a signal to the Pakistanis that the possibility of a larger scale reaction was serious. And the aircraft that the Indians used, Mirage 2000, is actually one of the systems that they used to carry nuclear weapons. So there was an implicit message in that strike. Fortunately, it looked very bad in terms of the possibility of a cycle of escalatory violence. But the Prime Minister of Pakistan, Imran Khan, decided once the pilot had been shot down, and that took place in dogfights along the line of control, to release him immediately rather than to hold him. And that kind of opened the door for the Indians to say that they had emerged victorious. And that allowed for some degree of de-escalation, a return to more normal levels of violence across the line of control. But still, the danger of two nuclear weapons states shooting at each other cannot be really underestimated.
Cannot be really underestimated, right, Michael Kugelman? I mean, there have been clashes before, but this time seems somewhat different over Kashmir and, you know, a sign that perhaps it's time to do something about this disputed territory. How do you see this recent clash?
Well, absolutely. I agree with Ambassador Olson that what happened was very significant. India and Pakistan have fought multiple wars before, but that was before they each officially became nuclear weapon states, which was 1999. Clearly, both sides appear to be comfortable using force on each other's soil under the nuclear umbrella. And to me, that's very significant because that means that whenever the next crisis happens, and there will be a next crisis, that means that each side will already be perfectly comfortable to start with the use of military force. I mean, as Ambassador Olson mentioned before, there was an incident back in 2016 when India did this modest airstrike along the contested border. Pakistan didn't respond. In fact, they denied that that strike had actually occurred. But in this case, you have India launching a strike in Pakistan, you have Pakistan responding with a strike in India, all under the nuclear umbrella. Clearly, each side was happy to climb up the escalation ladder. And the higher you go on the escalation ladder, the greater risk there is in the future for some type of nuclear exchange. I don't want to be an alarmist, but I think that we can't rule out the possibility of getting to that point.
Back to you, Ambassador Olson. A lot of people point their fingers at Pakistan. They continue to harbor terrorist groups, militant Islamist groups. But it seems that Pakistan has now launched what could be a long overdue crackdown on militant groups, particularly Jaish-e-Mohammed. Do you see that is actually occurring? If so, what has changed in your view?
Well, I think that the steps that the government of Pakistan has taken so far are positive. What I think remains to be seen is how effective they will be over time. The problem with Pakistani policy is usually not the stated policy, which is often and for many years has been commendable. It's against terrorism and against Pakistani territory being used against the neighbors. You know, and of course, for us, we are have been very concerned about safe haven of the Taliban and its use against Afghanistan. But the problem has been in implementation of actual crackdowns. And in the past, certain groups have been able, for instance, Lashkar-e-Taiba, which is another anti-India group, a Kashmiri group based in Pakistan, has been banned, but it has gone underground and has transmogrified itself into a different organization which continues to operate. So I think it remains to be seen how effective the Pakistan crackdown is. I think it's important for Pakistan, and not just for the sake of peace, but for Pakistan's own development and its reputation in the world, for it to crack down on these terrorist groups thoroughly.
Michael Kugelman, do you think it remains to be seen now how effective Pakistan is going to be? Imran Khan, the new prime minister, is this time different in your view vis-a-vis really cracking down on these Islamist terrorist groups?
It's too early to tell. And this really is a case of deja vu all over again, because Pakistan has staged these crackdowns before. What's happened in the past quite frequently is that a senior terrorist leader will be put under house arrest. But then what happens after some time has gone by and the headlines have disappeared, these leaders are quietly released. And then you also have cases of, you know, charities associated with terror groups being shut down by Pakistani authorities only to reappear under new names. And Pakistan doesn't do anything about that. I do think what may be different this time around is that Pakistan is facing very serious pressure, perhaps even unprecedented pressure from the international community to crack down, particularly, and the stakes are particularly high because Pakistan is going through a very serious economic crisis right now. And so you have certain international groups, including the Financial Action Task Force, which is a global organization that monitors terrorist financing. And it has watchlisted Pakistan for not doing enough to deal with terrorist financing. And if it believes that Pakistan continues to not do enough, it could blacklist the country, which would make it very difficult for Pakistan to do international business and to get foreign investment. Pakistan cannot afford to go through that right now because of its economic pains that it's suffering through. I would argue that the pressure is greater than it has ever been, but will that mean that Pakistan will actually act differently and take truly irreversible steps to deal with these terrorism problems? That I don't know.
Back to you, Ambassador Olson, and that leads us to talk about the role of outsiders, mediators for the region, especially with respect to this Kashmir conundrum. There's something about this disputed region that prevents Pakistan and India from coming to some kind of a modus vivendi. Do you see a formula for pacifying or somehow mollifying both sides? And to what extent is more international pressure required? What is the role of the United States and other actors? How do you see it?
It's, of course, an old dispute, and it goes right back to the partition of India in 1947 and the dispute over how the princely state of Kashmir joined India at the time. And Pakistanis and Indians both have very strong views on that subject. But India now regards this essentially as an internal matter and is reluctant to engage in an international dialogue on the future of Kashmir. So it seems to me that what will ultimately be necessary is the only real way out of this is something that was originally floated by President Musharraf when he was the president of Pakistan. I believe it was in 2004. The so-called Musharraf plan was essentially a plan for reducing tensions across the line of control, reducing the importance of the border, allowing Kashmiris on both sides, that is, in Pakistani-controlled and Indian-administered Kashmir, to engage in trade and commerce and build prosperity. I don't think, unfortunately, the time is ripe for such an initiative right now because there's so much distrust. I think it's going to require baby steps between India and Pakistan right now, and that's a little bit hard to imagine in the current political scenario with Indian elections coming up. But perhaps after the elections, it will be possible to build on some of the smaller steps.
Before the break, you get to respond, Michael Kugelman, with respect to how to deal with Kashmir. As the ambassador said, India sees it as more of an internal matter, and we're even seeing a lot of disgruntlement on the part of Kashmiris under Indian-controlled Kashmir, maybe even potential seeds for future attacks, but maybe this is not the right time. Wait till after the Indian elections. How do you see smaller steps or larger ones toward some kind of a solution to prevent this kind of conflict and violence?
There's a profound disconnect between India and Pakistan on Kashmir, which was alluded to before. Pakistan has been seeking international mediation because Pakistan is really keen for this disputed region to be addressed and renegotiated, whereas India thinks that there's nothing to discuss. It does not want outside mediation, because any outside mediation would bring up the possibility of India having to renegotiate the status of Kashmir. And it's true that now is not the time to think about small or large steps for the two sides to start talking about Kashmir. I think ideally what you would have is internal dialogue, but I just don't think that the current government, which of course is going to be facing elections in just a few weeks, is not interested in that type of discussion right now. And I would argue that, you know, we talk about how Pakistan has helped stir unrest in Kashmir, but I think it's important to highlight that the Indian policy in Kashmir in recent years has been very troubling, particularly under the current Narendra Modi-led government, where you have what I would describe as a tone-deaf policy. Essentially, the government claims it is going to promote more development in Kashmir to make people's lives better, whereas in fact, many Kashmiris, you know, they don't really care about prosperity. What they are worry about and are unhappy about is the heavy-handed tactics used by Indian security officials in Kashmir, which has indeed contributed to the unrest. And in fact, the young man that carried out the attack in Kashmir back on Valentine's Day that started this whole crisis, he was a local figure, and according to his parents, he was radicalized after he was beaten up by a few Indian police officers. So I think it's important to look at the Kashmir dispute from a broad lens and really emphasize that Pakistan and India are, I think, both implicated in what's going on there now.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first, you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Ambassador Richard Olson. He's with the United States Institute for Peace, and Michael Kugelman of the Wilson Center, and we are reviewing developments in South Asia, specifically tension between India and Pakistan, and we will soon be talking about the state of affairs in Afghanistan. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. It's also available on iTunes. You may follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Well, here's a shout out to a loyal listener, George Opar Onyango from Nairobi, Kenya. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page.
go back to you, Ambassador Olson, and just a quick, look at the Indian elections, the intersection between those elections and what just happened between India and Pakistan. You know, these elections are going to start taking place on April 11th, and then there are going to be a series of elections. It's a very big country. To what extent do you think this clash may have helped Prime Minister Modi, whose fortunes were sort of waning until he played this sort of tough guy with Pakistan, and that kind of bolstered his standing? How do you see this factoring into the re-election campaign?
I think that there are two ways in which we're likely to see some more tension during this period. First of all, I mean, for diplomats around the world, they recognize that when you go into an electoral season, the politicians have less room for maneuver, and they are going to be more inclined to take a hard line. And that seems to be almost a universal rule of politics, and so that's something that bodes poorly for, stability over the next month and a half. But in addition to that, unfortunately, the opposite dynamic seems to work for those who are opposed to peace processes and opposed to the peaceful settlement of these disputes. The terrorists are going to see this as an excellent opportunity to trigger the sort of crisis that they want to see happen. So all of the spoilers are going to be, unfortunately, incentivized to create problems in the month and a half ahead. And I think that the room for maneuver will be less. That's why this is really an issue that we have to continue to pay close attention to, because it's unfortunately possible that there will be a recurrence of some kind of attack and a heavy-handed response that may generate another escalatory cycle.
How do you see it, Michael Kugelman?
Yeah, well, I think that the best way to describe it is that this attack in Kashmir that precipitated this crisis was really an election gift, or it will be an election gift to Modi. The ruling party has been increasingly vulnerable in recent months. It was elected in 2014 on a platform, on a mandate to engage in economic reforms, and the government struggled to push a lot of those reforms through. The most alarming thing for the government is that unemployment has risen. And in fact, right before the crisis broke out between India and Pakistan, there was a huge domestic scandal in India because the Indian government essentially suppressed the release of a report that had been put together by a government-linked research organization that highlighted just how high the unemployment figures were, and that was suppressed by the Indian government. The opposition, the Congress party, the main opposition party, won a number of state elections over the last few months. So really, the ruling BJP party was looking particularly vulnerable. And then you had this attack and this crisis. And indeed, I do think that, largely speaking, the government has been able to count on a rally around the flag effect. And also, they have been given a great incentive to be really tough on Pakistan, to use tough talk against Pakistan on the campaign trail. And in India, when it's election season, if you talk tough on Pakistan, that's going to help you a lot.
Very good for re-election campaigns, but as Ambassador also noted, not really good for the long-term and
right.
long-term peace and stability. And we do have the party of Narendra Modi, a very Hindu nationalist party. But we'll have to leave that for another program. Let's turn now to Afghanistan in the few minutes we have left, because peace talks between the United States and the Taliban just concluded in Doha, Qatar. There was actually no breakthrough, but progress has been made, according to both sides, Ambassador Olson. But as I said in the introduction, there are gaps on the timeline for U.S. withdrawal of troops. We don't know about any guarantees from the Taliban that no terror attacks from Afghan soil would necessarily take place. But how do you see U.S. Special Envoy Zalmay Khalilzad's overtures to the Taliban? Do you think this will eventually bear fruit?
I'm cautiously optimistic about the talks, and it's important to remember that these are actually talks about talks. The formal peace negotiations have not actually begun. So what is being discussed is a modality for, as diplomats would say, for bringing about peace talks. And this is a very long history. The United States has been pursuing this since at least 2011. And the principal impediments in the past have been that the Taliban only wanted to talk about the withdrawal of U.S. forces. The Taliban was not prepared to break with al-Qaeda and international terrorism, and the Taliban was not prepared to deal with the Afghan government. What has changed is, under Ambassador Khalilzad, is that the U.S. has been at least prepared to talk about withdrawal. And no decisions on a timetable or withdrawal have been made. But the topic has been discussed at Doha as a possibility for how you would set up a structured peace process. Similarly, there are indications that the Taliban is indeed prepared to break with international terrorism and deal with the security concerns that drove the U.S. to invade Afghanistan in the first place in 2001. Where there has not been progress, as far as I can tell, is in the Taliban's refusal to deal with the Afghan government. So what I think is happening right now is that Ambassador Khalilzad is using the leverage of the discussions about withdrawal to try to get an intra-Afghan dialogue going, one between the Afghan government and the Taliban. That's what really has to happen in order for us to launch a formal peace process and bring about a political settlement to a war that's been going on in Afghanistan for 40 years, with us participating for 18 years.
So, Michael Kugelman, how do you see these talks going forward?
Well, I think the important thing to keep in mind is that these talks are essential. There's been plenty of talk and plenty of criticism about how this is a risky gambit. Why should we trust the Taliban? Why would the Taliban want to talk when it's doing so well on the battlefield? And I think the important thing to remember here is that the Taliban has, at least to this point, appeared to be quite committed for several reasons that you could highlight. One, you've had very senior Taliban officials present at these talks. And in fact, the lead Taliban negotiator at the most recent round of talks in Doha was a guy named Mullah Baradar, who is, I believe, one of the founding leaders of the Taliban, very high up at one point. He spent almost the last decade in a Pakistani jail. He was released, perhaps under U.S. pressure, just in time to lead the Taliban side in talks. The other thing is that this latest round of talks in Doha, it lasted for about 2 weeks. And I think that suggests the fact that each side was meeting each day for about 2 weeks, that indicates that they at least have plenty to talk about and wanted to try to make headway. That's important. You know, beyond that, certainly, there's a long way to go. I do think that the low-hanging fruit has been tackled first, which is probably what the Taliban wanted. The Taliban wants to, as soon as possible, get to some sort of agreement on some type of U.S. troop withdrawal plan. The U.S. would ideally want that discussion to include some type of focus on the whole intra-Afghan issue. And the fact that the issue of trying to bring Kabul into the talks has been put off for now, I think that's an indication of the Taliban's leverage and perhaps even a victory for the Taliban.
Well, as we close, and very briefly, back to you, Ambassador Olson, any final thoughts with respect to the Taliban?
Yeah, well, on the first point, that's why I think it really is essential that there be an intra-Afghan dialogue. That is to say, a dialogue between those who have benefited in the new order in Afghanistan over the past 18 years to engage in a structured negotiation with the Taliban. And there's really no substitute for this. I think particularly on certain key issues like women's rights, which are, you know, very important to us, but they're of fundamental importance to Afghans. The Taliban need to hear from Afghan women, not from Americans, the importance of what has been in place in Afghanistan for the past 18 years, the opportunities that have been taken and how a new Afghanistan could be built, maybe with Taliban inclusion. So I think the goal has to be to have this kind of negotiation. And I think when it happens, the upholders of the current order will have more political strength than they think. The Taliban may have a certain amount of military strength, but they don't have, I think, broad popular support in the same way that the government potentially does.
You get the final word, Michael Kugelman, on to what extent the Taliban can truly change their nature, which memories of which are of extremism, misogyny, intolerance of the new generation and their parents.
Yeah, and that's just a hard question to answer right now. I mean, one could certainly understand why so many Afghans are so worried about these initial talks, particularly the fact that Kabul's not involved, given what the Taliban did several decades ago. And you know, the Taliban has projected itself as a more moderate Taliban 2.0. Can we trust that? I don't know. But the bottom line is that the war is getting worse. There have been record levels of civilian casualties in the last year. The drug production has set records. Afghan security forces have been dying at an unprecedented level. So clearly, warts and all, I think that this negotiation process is still something that has to take place because there's no alternative.
Well, on that cautiously optimistic note, that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Ambassador Richard Olson. He's senior advisor at the U.S. Institute of Peace, and Michael Kugelman, deputy director of the Asia Program and senior associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center. Gentlemen, thanks so much for coming in and sharing your terrific insights.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Patrice Martin for booking our guests. Our engineer was Wojtek Zorniak. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.